So we are. Any questions about anything before we start? I imagine, again, that the hit of a novel on top of the exam is pretty demanding on you. But it's an immensely readable novel. I was going to ask how many people have read Halfway, but I don't want to know. I don't think. But I'll find out by trying to start a discussion. There's a sense in which Mr. Woodhouse, Emma's father, is an interesting character because he really represents England for a certain quality of England for Austen, which is the desire for as small a life as possible, right? I mean, he just doesn't want to move. And he represents a certain kind of constraint on Emma's life and on the life of the whole small town, which is a crucial feature of the novel. They really have to live their lives under non-cosmopolitan conditions, right? I mean, but I also think that sometimes he's a figure for Austen's own novels. That is, they're so small, right? I mean, I'm teaching the epic in the other class, and it's an amazing kind of contrast, you know, to go to Austen's novels. So if Austen some morning said, you know, my novels are really small, how could she defend herself? How could she build back her ego? What are the possible strengths of the smallness of the world that she represents? That's very interesting. Any other? Go ahead. But suppose my answer to that would be, I'm a modernist, right? And so we, most of us, really hate identification. Like, it's too easy. You don't work hard enough. What's the danger of the very virtues that you're talking about, that is relatability? Yeah. But how can she compensate for that? I think there's a very good answer. But what kind of human problems, let's say, she's not using a microscope rather than a telescope, right? I mean, that's one way. Go ahead. That's going to be a magical word in just a minute, so yeah. No, absolutely, actually, right? And Knightley is the character who makes accurate judgments. One of the issues in the novel is, how can you value this guy, right? How can you love that guy? He doesn't dance. How can you love somebody who doesn't dance? I mean, that's a marvelous challenge in the book. How can you love somebody who doesn't dance? Go ahead. So, I mean, what lies behind this is that maybe a single virtue is wrong to imagine, in a certain sense. What parable virtues are kind of interesting, right? Especially in this world where you have to couple, or you go crazy, right? It's like going to Dartmouth or something. I mean, you know, there's just nothing except the other people who are around you. I never thought of that, but, you know, so, of course, Knightley is limited. But it's a limitation that can be balanced because it's not blind, right? And so everybody's limited in a sense. That's part of Austen's world and sort of Austenian coming to terms with humanity. But some vices are negotiable across others, and some are absolutely blinding. What makes a vice blind in this novel? We'll do this all concretely in a minute, but I want to sort of set the stage. I mean, why is, in one sense, right, Elton and Emma are equally wrong in their behavior towards Harriet, right? I mean, what makes Elton's vice worse than Emma's vice? Or another way to put it is, why does Elton find his perfect match after that? What do they have in common? Well, again, I'm going to say this again, but what they have in common is a kind of imaginary narrowness which becomes self-defensive. And it's as if what Emma's saving quality is when she makes a mistake, she feels the mistake and opens up the possibility that she was wrong. There's an interesting thing. You'll see it. She admits that she's wrong about Harriet, but not about John Morton, right? I mean, because she's got to protect herself somehow. But that's one of the things that Austin is really fascinated by, I think, is how we make judgments. That's the crucial. The romantics, all that we saw, sort of link judgment with reason and stressed imagination. But for Austin, that's crazy. Because we're always making judgments, and if we don't have imagination in the judgments, then we're kind of immensely trapped. Imagination makes judgment sort of generous in a way. Go ahead. No, I think that's right. I mean, Emma begins as an absolute romantic, and Austin is vicious to her, I think. But that romantic attitude is redeemable, because at least it's generous, and it can correlate with judgment. But that's why, sort of, in simple terms, Knightley represents judgment, and Emma represents a certain kind of imaginative enthusiasm. And when they get together, that actually bodes well for the future, because each one can open up the other, and also each one can temper the other. And that's a kind of ideal situation. When the best thing in the novel is when Knightley's kind of finally stumbles to propose to Emma, and Emma has like a paragraph-long sentence. She can't say everything she wants to say about, you know, but he finally did it. It's just a great moment in the book and worth reading for. All right. But what, so the psychology is that you're constantly making judgments, that is, especially in a small world. I mean, who your friends are going to be, what time you're going to be with your friends, what kinds of virtues your friends have, what kind of vices your friends have. Who will complete you? Who will harm you? Right. I mean, part of the power of this small world is it immediately adapts or demands psychological adjustment, and that sense of continuous demand on judgment is the kind of central feature of the novel. I think in some ways it's like The Country Wife, except The Country Wife values the judgment very differently. Okay. Now, what goes wrong in judgment is mainly the imaginary nature of a self. Okay. And I'm just going to do a very brief and really shoddy summary of just one idea of this psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, whom you will hear about if you haven't heard about it in other classes. But I'm only interested in this notion that when a child is born, the child gets a name from the mother or at the mother's breast. And for Lacan, at least, this child thinks that the name belongs to him, or mainly him, actually, because it comes with so much love from the mother. But the whole sense of the importance of the belonging to a name is an illusion. It's an illusion created by, in a sense, the need for the mother. Lacan had the highest rate of suicide among psychoanalysts in France by an immense notion, because, I mean, the point is, you're nothing. Get used to it, right? I mean, but the specific notion of why am I entitled to imagine me as important, right? I mean, that's the strange, I mean, I'm like everybody else. What makes me have a right to importance? Well, in a certain sense, that sense of as you're nourishing, you're physically, you're sort of the female principle, doesn't have to be the mother, in a sense, is giving you a name and sort of saying you're worthy of this nourishment because you're you, all right? And that's what he calls the imaginary dimension of life, this sense, this illusory sense that you matter, okay? Just as a footnote, the father comes along and says, hey, schmuck, you're like everybody else, right? I mean, that's sort of the father's role. Because the father sort of introduces this symbolic order where names are not for you, but they're named by which you join social operations, right? And partially, life becomes reconciling the fact that you're a schmuck with the sense that you're special, right? I mean, that's, or at least having to come to terms with that psychological aspect. Now, this imaginariness is interesting partially because there's a part then of the world which when it comes, that you want to find your specialness, right? So that even when Emma meets Harriet, right? Harriet becomes a replacement for Miss Taylor, who's gotten married. And Emma sees Harriet largely as a kind of set of functions in her eyes. Look on 15, just as a... I can do this whole... She'd ventured once alone to Randall's, but I was not pleasant, the beginning of chapter 4. And Harriet Smith, therefore, one whom she could summon at any time to a walk, would be a valuable addition to her privileges. But in every respect, as she saw more of her, she approved her and was confirmed in all her kind design. Harriet certainly was not clever, but she had a sweet, docile, grateful disposition, was totally free from conceit, and only designed to be guided by anyone she looked up to. Her early attachment to herself was very amiable, and her inclination for good company and power of appreciating what was elegant and clever showed that there was no want of taste, or strength of understanding must not be expected. Altogether, she was quite convinced of Harriet Smith being exactly the young friend she wanted, exactly the something which her home required. Such a friend as Mrs. Weston was out of the question, okay, because she had now a family. But the whole sense of almost as if Harriet comes because Emma's entitled to a friend, right? And she sees this view in terms of that sense of entitlement. Now, that kind of trait of taking things in imaginatively is prone to two kinds of errors. And they're interestingly connected, and they're deep in all of us. The one is you project, right, so that you can try out various lives that you might have onto the other person. It's less risky. So the whole notion of finding a beau for Harriet is partially Emma's desire to have romance without responsibility for romance, right? I mean, remember, Emma says that it'd be hard for her to marry because she's got so much power in her household already. I mean, it's a very serious theme for feminists who deal with this novel. But so there's a strong incentive to sort of have romance through Harriet, all right? But the other feature, so there's this projective part. The other feature is the defensive part, because if you really believe that, you know, you're special, then part of that specialness is the sense that people who don't regard it, who don't honor it, are wrong, right? I mean, the first impulse is not, what am I wrong, but how can I protect myself? How can I protect my specialness? So the experience of the conjunction between projection outward onto Harriet, what she needs, and I must be right. Knightley can't be right about this because I'm me, and he's like distant, but I'm the real matchmaker character, and I see what Elton does, all right? So there's this relation between defensiveness and imaginary projection that's fundamental to character. Now, there's another level, which I don't understand. I'll try to work it out for next time, in which Frank Churchill and Jane Fairfax, who have secrets, have a different kind of defensiveness that they need. And that would be a kind of interesting version of a paper. What does it mean to have a secret in this small world? You know, what's your psychological life then? But I just draw a blank when I ask those questions. All right. So you notice actually that Emma has this very strong imagination. That's the romantic part. She has to experience the dangers of that, trusting that imagination. I mean, that's the sort of conservative aspect of Austen's imagination. And the dangers are the sense of projection and the sense of defense. And they're interestingly connected because Emma is not only defensive overtly about her choice, but she may be defensive psychologically about the whole issue of marriage, right? I mean, that is one of the things also that imaginations can do is produce substitutes. So that it's too risky for you to do because you can be rejected. So you sort of project onto this person the whole adventure of courtship. And part of, again, I'm not rich enough on this, but somebody could do a good job on it. The whole idea of you, right? I mean, that's the joke in the novel in the first part, right? I mean, Elton's you is Emma. Emma has to read you as Harriet, right? So the whole notion of taking responsibility for the pronouns that one may be addressed, is part of this drama of what it means to be a self, right? In other words, if Emma heard the you of Elton as, I'm talking about Emma, then she'd have to work out a response to him. She'd have to really trust the fact that she despises the guy, right? But by sort of deflecting that pronoun, not taking responsibility for hearing what's being said, she can both control Harriet's situation and avoid her situation, all right? Because again, part of this drama of Mama saying, you, Charlie, right? All of a sudden, wow, I must have an inside that's named Charlie, right? I mean, I'm this, you know, this bundle of whining and desires as a kid. All of a sudden, Mama's saying, you have an identity, kid, you know? And all of a sudden, the world as Charlie becomes a lot more important than the world of anybody else. And that's kind of what Austen's playing with. There's a figure that Lacan uses that I just love this figure. It's one of my squiggles again. Right? This is you as an infant, okay? And Lacan uses the word omelet, okay? It's an omelet. But you break the egg on the pan. And this is your egg on the pan, right? Then Mama comes along, cooks the omelet, right? All of a sudden, this is Charlie, see? I mean, now I'm a person, but all of a sudden, I have to protect all of these things that were just fizzling desires at some point on the pot. Now they're whole, they have a shape, and I'm responsible for them, okay? And I'm also responsible to evade them if they hurt, right? So I think that the kind of picture that Austen has of what it means to be a kind of desiring machine with the possibility of judgment. How do you control this desire machine? Anyway, all right. Let's go now to the what I actually had sort of planned to do. Why in Austen, reading is a kind of crucial figure for judgment. That is, in a sense, a character gets fixed when one writes something down. And I was only remembering that there's the John Morton letter, right? And then there are the various riddles that Elton does as also versions of this kind of fixity of writing. Though he's trying to avoid fixity because he's an ass. But you remember in the John Morton letter, Emma is upset because he's objectively richer and more full than he had thought. But that whole experience of writing as objectification is kind of crucial to the novel, and also to what Austin does, I think. That's the point that I want to make. So I asked the question in the B space about what makes an Austin sentence, and I'll come to that in a bit. But I want to just do a passage where Harriet decides, in effect, to refuse John Morton, and ask why it's written this way. It's on 32, chapter 7, if you're using a different edition, like the second page of chapter 7. "Yes, but what shall I see, dear Murderhood, dear Mr. Woodhouse? Do advise me. Oh, no, the letter had much better be all your own. You will express yourself very properly, I'm sure. There's no danger of your not being intelligible, which is the first thing. Your meaning must be unequivocal. No doubts or demurs. Such expressions of gratitude and concern for the pain you're inflicting as propriety requires will present themselves unbidden to your mind. I'm persuaded. You need not be prompted to write with the appearance of sorrow for his disappointment." She's actually just dictating to Harriet without knowing it, right? But then, "You think I ought to refuse him then?" Harriet said, looking down. I mean, Harriet looking for any straw here to escape this fate, right? "You ought to refuse him? My dear Harriet, what do you mean? Are you in any doubt as to that? I thought, but I beg your pardon, perhaps I've been under a mistake. I certainly have been misunderstanding you if you feel doubt as to the purport of your answer. I had imagined you were consulting me only as to the wording of it." Harriet was silent. With a little reserve of manner, Emma continued, "You mean to return a favorable answer, I collect? No, I do not. I do not mean. What shall I do? What would you advise me to do? Pray, dear Mudos, tell me what I should do." And then on the next page, at the first paragraph, "Oh, no, I'm sure you're a great deal too kind to, but if you would just advise me what I had best do." "No, I don't mean that. As you say, one's mind ought to be quite made up. One should not be hesitating. It's a very serious thing. It will be safer to say no. Perhaps. Do you think I had better say no?" "Not for the world," said Emma, smiling graciously, "would I advise you either way. You must be the best judge of your own happiness." Right. She's smiling graciously because she knows. But why does Austin tease this out and project Martin's fate to this particular kind of dialogue? What result does she want in the audience? I mean, she could have, right? Emma could have persuaded Harriet. Harriet could have persuaded herself. Why stage this dialogue? Go ahead. Okay, that's a crucial kind of part of it. And there's a very, based on blindness, right? I mean, that is, it's crucial that Emma can't see Harriet's needs or hesitations. I mean, but why enact the scene? Well, I guess I answered the question. I mean, partially because it's so painful, right? I mean, it's a version of a letter, actually, in the sense that it's completely, all novelists continually are choosing between what you could call rendering and narrating, right? I mean, that is, they can tell the story in various ways. When they choose to render, that is to do it scenically with an action, there's usually a reason why that choice is being made, right? That choice is being made here because it's so different when you actually have to hear Emma's sense that she knows for Harriet Because it's great in the sense that two people's pain becomes active in the novel, to become active in the novel, because of the rendering. That is Harriet's pain in doing it, and John Martin's pain because of the poor guy is being screwed by this enterprise. And so part of the genius of the writing is dramatizing these moments where there are very complex possibilities of emotion that you have to read into. If you don't read into it, you're not going to feel it the same. You're not going to feel it the same way. Go ahead. I haven't read the finished novel yet. Right. And how can Knightley enter the world, right, since he's so self-protective? Knightley is always judging, but never desiring. Right? He's always watching. That's part of the consequence of his dancing. And part of what Emma has to see is he's seeing things when he's watching. That's what Emma has to come to trust. Whereas Frank Churchill is dancing. Why? Because Frank Churchill is the absolute performer, right? I mean, they're totally different in that sense. And Churchill has charm. He has self-presence. But he doesn't have moral character. I had a friend who said once, quoting Emerson, I didn't know that, you have many virtues, but no character. And that's a great, turned out very accurate to me, but it's also a great description of a certain kind of performative character that Austin captured. All right, but anyway, my points were two. That one is just the power of the writing to control when action occurs and what happens. And that control is like giving a letter in the sense that you read it objectively rather than through someone's eyes. That's actually the point. I didn't see the point I was making. If you could read this through Emma's eyes in a summary, it'd be so totally different from seeing Harriet's pain, right, that Emma doesn't see. So it has to be dramatic to recognize what a character doesn't see in the moment. All right. I want to just point out the sort of great Austin sentences and then talk more about what it means to be a character in a novel, because it's a kind of interesting dilemma. But I just, two sentences, I just... the opening sentence, right? I mean, the opening sentence is absolutely crucial. At least, it's not really crucial, but it's nice to have writers imagining that it is crucial, because it becomes a kind of signature. All right. Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich, with a comfortable home and happy disposition, seems to unite some of the blessed blessings of existence, and had lived nearly 21 years in the world with very little to distress or vex her. What does that sentence show about the author? How does she want to enter the text, the author? Because, I mean, the author is a real presence in a Jane Austen text. Anybody? Go ahead. Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Anything else? Why would those phrases be, what's the term? Appositions, right? They're just Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich. Why attach them to her in that way rather than saying Emma Woodhouse, because she was handsome, clever, and rich, right, did something, or... at 21, Emma Woodhouse seemed handsome, clever, and rich. Why just have those? Go ahead. Absolutely. Right. Well, that's very interesting. So, smallness is one way to put it. How else might you put that, what the linguistic connection is suggesting about Emma's character? I mean, again, it's not a big thing, but it's kind of interesting. I mean, that is, there's certainly a kind of distancing because of the appositional nature of that phrase, right? Especially with a second modifying principle with a comfortable home and happy disposition. So there's two different modes of modification of the noun, Emma Woodhouse. But why this mode of modification in the noun? Well, I think you got it better than I had, actually, in the sense that it suggests that these attributes are right about Emma, but there's a kind of distance between Emma and the attributes, or the attributes don't really make the person. They're almost surface attributes that she has to take responsibility for. The ownership is not direct, and I think that's the point of the modification. And also, then the novelist is saying, well, you know. I'm going to do things with handsome, clever, and rich. I mean, they're not owned yet, right? I mean, you're going to have to take a whole novel to go on. Go ahead, Rich. Right. No, that's and what vex means, really, I mean, artificial vexation and other kinds of vexation is part of. You'll see that. She really does Mrs. Bates wrong, and Knightley calls her on it. But you have to read back to page 55 to see why she does this to Mrs. Bates. And go ahead. Well, how does that fit with had lived nearly 21 years in the world with very little actually distress? Right, you can see even that there are two perspectives. As if one of the things I'll talk about is there's a principle in the novel called indirect. What the hell is it called? Forget that. Yeah, where the novel seems to be narrating in third person, but it gravitates towards what the first person would be thinking. And even here, had lived nearly 21 years in the world. For Emma, that's an accomplishment, right? And it says, that's a long time for 20. But for the author, it's a total nothing, right? It's a kind of total absence. So it's almost that kind of distance that Pope has in the Rape of the Lock. There was something, go ahead. Uh-huh. Right. Do you remember why she can't resist? I mean, you have to infer. But I think she has contempt for Mrs. Bates. You know, she's just and Emma hasn't faced that contempt. And it sort of grinds on her, and then, you know, because she says she can't resist, but there's not a lot of resistance there because she has this kind of contempt. Oh, yeah, and well, not bad. Knightley has to call her on it. But then she feels terrible about it. And that's what I wanted to make sure that well, let me do one more sentence. And then I want to deal with how the difference between kinds of characters in this novel, and therefore the status of defensiveness. I don't know why I'm really interested in defensiveness these days. I think it's the main kind of limitation on most of our lives. We're so protective of what we have, and so scared to make mistakes or commitments. That is a kind of version of Austin's hell, I think. But one more sentence on 104. It's volume 2, the end of chapter 1. It's involved with Jane Austen and Jane Fairfax and Mrs. Bates. And not all that could be urged to detain her succeeded. She regained the street. Happy at this, in this, that though much had been forced on her against her will, so she'd in fact heard the whole substance of Jane Fairfax's letter, she'd been able to escape the letter itself. Why is that interesting writing, first, and what does it suggest? Why is Jane Fairfax such a problem for Emma? Jane Fairfax will not give Emma any access to power. Because she's just, but you learn why by the end of the novel. But she's just a kind of reserved character. And Emma's kind of energy, which is the good part, but also, and Jane Fairfax is the opposite of Harriet, right? I mean, Harriet is always bubbly and she can be manipulated. Jane Fairfax will give Emma nothing. So, just in general, Emma can't find her weaknesses and also can't find how she succeeds with her, right? I mean, this kind of performative character hates people who are reserved because they don't know whether they're doing well or not, right? It's madness. I once had these two women who didn't like me in my previous job. And they sat absolutely across from me in a circle. These idiots, they just sit in a circle and I give a paper. And I was stuck staring at these women for 2 hours and they would not smile. And here I am performing, you know, and trying to make people laugh. And they just sat there. And that was kind of hell because I just didn't. But I think that's kind of how Emma responds to Jane Fairfax. You know, she just, all the wiles that Emma has just don't work on her. But then it's also important that Jane Fairfax is better than Emma at the various skills of the upper bourgeois woman. So it's especially crucial that Jane won't give her anything so she can't get a kind of revenge. She can't have any way to say, oh, well, Jane is a better singer, and Jane is a better piano player, but I know something about Jane, right, that I can be better about. So there's no access to... go ahead. Oh, she's actually successfully defended. And it becomes actually a virtue, at least from... You mean Emma can? Yeah, no, I think that's right. Go ahead. Oh, right, no, that's the business about being able to escape the letter itself would just be, like, Emma's real deep imagination is, why doesn't Jane Fairfax just disappear? Right, I mean, and so when she returns, it throws Emma's life. But it also, I think, it's probably connected to Frank Churchill, well, it is in the narrative. But Emma, maybe, the novel doesn't state this, but because of competition with Jane Fairfax, becomes interested in the marriage market more than she is in the... In the beginning, again, how much you can say that the novel doesn't say, I don't know, but it would make sense said, all right, you know, if I can't beat her in piano playing, I could just get her husband at least, right? It turns out to be her husband. That's, or fiance. You have to read the novel twice, actually, Ridgway, because, I'll tell you this. I mean, Jane Fairfax and Frank Churchill are engaged. I mean, and they don't say that till the very end of the novel. And so some of the passages when actually, I tell you that now so you don't have to reread it, but you see that there's one way to read it if you know it, and then another way to read it if you don't. And that was part of Austen's game in the novel, was to have the sense that you can, when you know it, you read it one way, when you don't, you read it another way, which is hard to do. All right, I just want to make sure, I think it's obvious enough in a way, but there are interesting structural features. That is, volume one is carried by the Harriet and Elton sort of issues, and they're fairly disposable, and everything works out in the end. And it's replaced in volume two by Jane Fairfax and Frank Churchill, much more complicated sort of adult relations, partially because, again, they have secrets and they don't quite fit into the set. But early on, the novel suggests that to have a character is in a certain sense a trap, unless you have a kind of revisability. And Elton is the great version of that. I think Emma finally says that he sounds always on stage, right? There's a kind of deep insincerity about the guy because he only hears himself. He's like an academic, actually. I mean, he's a preacher. They're all similar. But there's this sense that he's totally locked into his role because there's no core self there. I mean, he's been so absorbed by his role, so that a description just does for him, and he doesn't enter the world beyond those roles. That's sort of true for Harriet as well. It's absolutely true for Elton's next wife when she comes. They learn nothing. I mean, that's the central nature. That's where I think the defensiveness comes in. They have to protect their status so much that they can't pay attention to anything that might threaten that status. This is the stage in which Emma's reaction to learning what she did in this situation is so powerful, I think. Because what Emma is endlessly changeable. That is, she needs to include the truth in thinking well of herself. It's also that opening sentence. It's as if Emma could have said that, right? Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich with a comfortable home. It's this borderline between what the narrator knows and what the character could say that's part of the kind of intimacy of Austen's relation to. But she doesn't stop with that because she has a kind of capacity for shame, and that's the crucial. So this is on 87, then 88. The hair was curled and the maid sent away, and Emma sat down to think and be sensible. All the great women novelists, they love moments when the characters go away and just have quiet moments and they realize what they've done. I mean, that's, including Henry James, which is not there, but the hair was curling. It was a wretched business indeed. Such an overthrow of everything she'd wished for. Such a development of everything most unwelcome. Such a blow for Harriet. That was worst of all. And you can see the pull. Is it for Harriet or is it for her? But she keeps the Harriet presence, and that's the part that then she's growable about. Each part of it brought pain and humiliation of some sort or other. But compared with evil to Harriet, all was light, and she would gladly have submitted to feel yet more mistaken, more in error, more disgraced by misjudgment than she actually was, could the effort of her blunders have been confined to herself. If I'd not persuaded Harriet into liking the man, I could have borne anything. He might have doubled his presumption to me. But poor Harriet, how could she have been so deceived? And then, where is it? On 89, she returns to this situation again about Elton. But he fancied herself in love with him, and that evidently must have been his dependence, and therefore raving a little about the seeming incongruity of gentle manners and a conceited head. Emma was obliged in common honesty to stop and admit her home behavior to him had been so complacent and obliging, so full of courtesy and attention, as supposing a real motive unperceived might warrant a man of ordinary observation and delicacy like Mr. Elton in fancying himself a very decided favorite. If she had so misinterpreted his feelings, she had little right to wonder that he, with self-interest to blind him, should have mistaken hers. This is a great human moment. That is, if she can imagine herself as mistaken, she can imagine him as mistaken and give a certain kind of embrace the magnitude of her mistake, but give him a certain kind of credit. And she goes on, the first error and the worst lay at her door. It was foolish. It was wrong to take so active a part in bringing two people together. It was adventurous too far, assuming too much, making light of what ought to be serious, a trick of what ought to be simple. She was quite concerned and ashamed to resolve to do such things no more. Here have I, said she, actually talked poor Harry into being very much attached to this man. She might never have heard of him but for me, and certainly never would have thought of him with hope if I had not assured her of his attachment. For is she as modest and humble as I used to think him? Oh, that I had been satisfied with persuading her not to accept young Martin. There I was right. That was well done of me, but I should have stopped. I mean, she needs something out of this situation. So Austin doesn't want to have a kind of total turn, partially because she has to make this larger mistake that'll connect her to Knightley. But again, the possibility of connection depends on the possibility of a kind of enlargement to see the other's situation. And that's the real difference in the sort of the characters who can build a future in a community and the characters who will only repeat its vices, which is kind of basic to the novel. Okay, just one last word. The other thing that's that I didn't bring out that's kind of important is the way in which Austin doesn't know what to do with this, actually. In one sense, Austin is an interesting writer because she has a very conservative disposition, but a very romantic sense of what people are and what possibilities. So, for example, part of the treatment of Elton, Emma keeps saying, he's a gentleman. But since Elton becomes such an ass, what's the status of gentlemanly virtue? Right? Well, Blake would say, gentlemanly virtues are just illusions. Austin has to reconstruct gentlemanly virtues in Knightley so that the gentlemanly virtues aren't at fault, just Elton is, right? But it's interesting that she has this romantic sensibility that has to keep catching itself within her social conservatism. That's part of the kind of interest, I think, of the novel. And I don't know what, you know, Austin would think about gentlemanly virtues, finally. But certainly just the dismissal of certain kind of acceptance of class. For example, one of the reasons why Knightley totally wants to have Harriet and John Martin together is they're the same class. I mean, Knightley is very conservative in that sense. But Austin has to defend the kind of lucid, intelligent conservatism rather than a kind of knee-jerk, class-based conservatism. I mean, that's part of her politics. All right, so we'll deal mainly with how they get together. It's really charming in the end of the book, and what makes it finally a comedy. Okay.